Last Chance to See by Douglas Adams and Mark Carwardine. Tweak technology. This isn't at all what I expected. In 1985, by some sort of journalistic accident, I was sent to Madagascar with Mark Carwardine to look for an almost extinct form of lemur called the aye-aye. None of the three of us had met before. I had never met Mark, Mark had never met me, and no one, apparently, had seen an aye-aye in years. This was the idea of the Observer Colour magazine, to throw us all in at the deep end. Mark is an extremely experienced and knowledgeable zoologist, working at that time for the World Wildlife Fund, and his role, essentially, was to be the one who knew what he was talking about. My role, and one for which I was entirely qualified, was to be an extremely ignorant non-zoologist, to whom everything that happened would come as a complete surprise. All the aye-aye had to do was do what aye-ayes have been doing for millions of years, sit in a tree and hide. The aye-aye is a nocturnal lemur. It's a very strange-looking creature that seems to have been assembled from bits of other animals. It looks a little like a large cat with a bat's ears, a beaver's teeth, a tail like a large ostrich feather, a middle finger like a long dead twig, and enormous eyes that seem to peer past you into a totally different world which exists just over your left shoulder. Like virtually everything that lives on Madagascar, it does not exist anywhere else on Earth. Its origins date back to a period in Earth's history when Madagascar was still part of mainland Africa, which itself had been part of the gigantic supercontinent of Gondwanaland, at which time the ancestors of the Madagascan lemurs were the dominant primate in all the world. When Madagascar sheared off into the Indian Ocean, it became entirely isolated from all the evolutionary changes that took place in the rest of the world. It is a life raft from a different time. It is now almost like a tiny, fragile, separate planet. The major evolutionary change which passed Madagascar by was the arrival of the monkeys. These were descended from the same ancestors as the lemurs, but they had bigger brains and were aggressive competitors for the same habitat. Where the lemurs had been content to hang around in trees, having a good time, the monkeys were ambitious and interested in all sorts of things, especially twigs, with which they found they could do all kinds of things that they couldn't do by themselves. Digging for things, probing things, hitting things. The monkeys took over the world, and the lemur branch of the primate family died out everywhere, other than Madagascar, which for millions of years the monkeys never reached. Then, 1,500 years ago, the monkeys finally arrived, or at least the monkeys' descendants, us. Thanks to astounding advances in twig technology, we arrived in canoes, then boats, and finally aeroplanes, and once again started to compete for use of the same habitat, only this time with fire and machetes and domesticated animals, with asphalt and concrete. The lemurs are once again fighting for survival. My aeroplane, full of monkey descendants, arrived in Tananarive Airport. Mark, who had gone out ahead to make the arrangements for the expedition, met me for the first time there and explained the setup. "Everything's gone wrong," he said. He was tall, dark, and laconic, and had a slight nervous tic. He explained that he used to be just tall, dark, and laconic, but that the events of the last few days had rather got to him. At least he tried to explain this. He had also lost his voice, he croaked, due to a lot of recent shouting. "I nearly telexed you not to come," he said. "The whole thing's a nightmare. I've been here for 5 days and I'm still waiting for something to go right. The ambassador in Brussels promised me that the Ministry of Agriculture will be able to provide us with 2 Land Rovers and a helicopter. Turns out all they've got is a moped and it doesn't work. The ambassador in Brussels also assured me that we could drive right to the north, but the road suddenly turns out to be impassable because it's being rebuilt by the Chinese, only we're not supposed to know that. And what exactly is meant by suddenly, I don't know, because they've been apparently at it for 10 years. Anyway, I think I've managed to sort something out. But we have to hurry," he added. "The plane to the jungle leaves in 2 hours, and we have to be on it. We've just got time to dump your surplus baggage at the hotel if we're quick. Some of it is surplus, isn't it?" He looked anxiously at the pile of bags that I was lugging, and then with increasing alarm at the cases of Nikon camera bodies, lenses and tripods that our photographer, Alan Agasmir, who had been with me on the plane, was busy loading into the minibus. "Oh, that reminds me," he said. "I've just found out that we probably won't be allowed to take any film out of the country." I climbed rather numbly into the minibus. After 13 hours on the plane from Paris, I was tired and disoriented, and had been looking forward to a shower, a shave, a good night's sleep, and then maybe a gentle morning, trying gradually to find Madagascar on the map over a pot of tea. I tried to pull myself together and get a grip. I suddenly had not the faintest idea what I, a writer of humorous science fiction adventures, was doing here. I sat blinking in the glare of the tropical sun and wondered what on earth Mark was expecting of me. He was hurrying around, tipping one porter, patiently explaining to another porter that he hadn't actually carried any of our bags, conducting profound negotiations with the driver, and gradually pulling some sort of order out of the chaos. Madagascar, I thought. Aye, I thought. A nearly extinct lemur. Heading out to the jungle in 2 hours' time. I desperately needed to sound bright and intelligent. Do you think we're actually going to get to see this animal? I asked Mark as he climbed in and slammed the door. He grinned at me. Well, the ambassador to Brussels said we hadn't got a hope in hell, he said, so we may just be in with a chance. Welcome, he added, as we started the slow pothole slalom into town, to Madagascar. What you see on the map as Antananarivo is pronounced Tananarive, and for much of the century has been spelt that way as well. When the French took over Madagascar at the end of the last century, colonized is probably too kind a word for moving in on a country that was doing perfectly well for itself, but which the French simply took a fancy to, they were impatient with the curious Malagasy habit of not bothering to pronounce the first and last syllables of place names. They decided, in their rational Gallic way, that if that was how the names were pronounced, they could damn well be spelt that way, too. It'd be rather as if someone had taken over England and told us that from now on we would be spelling Leicester, L-E-S-T-E-R, and liking it. We might be forced to spell it that way, but we wouldn't like it, and neither did the Malagasy. As soon as they managed to divest themselves of French rule in the 1960s, they promptly reinstated all the old spellings and just kept the cooking and the bureaucracy. One of the more peculiar things that has happened to me is that, as a result of an idea I had as a penniless hitchhiker sleeping in fields and telephone boxes, publishers now send me around the world on expensive author tours, and put me up in the sort of hotel room where you have to open several doors before you find the bed. In fact, I had just arrived directly from a US author tour, which was exactly like that, and so my first reaction to finding myself sleeping on concrete floors in spider-infested huts in the middle of the jungle was, oddly enough, one of fantastic relief. Weeks of mind-numbing American Expressness dropped away like mud in the shower, and I was able to lie back and enjoy being wonderfully, serenely, hideously uncomfortable. I could tell that Mark didn't realize this, and was at first rather anxious, showing me to my patch of floor. Will this be all right? I was told there'd be mattresses. We can fluff up the concrete a little for you. And I had to keep on saying, you don't understand, this is great, this is wonderful, I've been looking forward to this for weeks. In fact, we were not able to lie back at all. The aye-aye is a nocturnal animal and does not make daytime appointments. The few aye-ayes that were known to exist in 1985 were to be found, or more usually not found, on a tiny idyllic rainforest island called Nosy Mangabe, just off the northeast coast of Madagascar, to which they had been removed 20 years earlier. This was their last refuge on earth. And no one was allowed to visit the island without special government permission, which Mark had managed to arrange for us. This was where our hut was, and this was where we spent night after night, thrashing through the rainforest in torrential rain, carrying tiny, feeble torches. The big, powerful ones we'd brought on the plane stayed with the surplus baggage we dumped in the Tananarive Hilton. Until we found the aye-aye. That was the extraordinary thing. We actually did find the creature. We only caught a glimpse of it for a few seconds, slowly edging its way along a branch a couple of feet above our heads, and looking down at us through the rain with a sort of serene incomprehension as to what kind of things we might possibly be. But it was the kind of moment about which it is hard not to feel completely dizzy. Why? Because, I realized later, I was a monkey looking at a lemur. By flying from New York and Paris to Tananarive by 747 jet, up to Diego Suarez in an old prop plane, driving to the port of Maro, etc. in an even older truck, crossing to Nosy Mangabe in a boat that was so old and dilapidated that it was almost indistinguishable from driftwood, and finally walking by night into the ancient rainforest, We were almost making a time journey back through the stages of our experiments in twig technology to the environment from which we had originally ousted the lemurs. And here was one of the very last of them, looking at me with, as I say, serene incomprehension. The following day, Mark and I sat on the steps of the hut in the morning sunshine, making notes and discussing ideas for the article I would write for The Observer about the expedition. He had explained to me in detail the history of the lemurs, and I said that I thought there was an irony to it. Madagascar had been a monkey-free refuge for the lemurs off the coast of mainland Africa, and now Nosy Mangabey had to be a monkey-free refuge off the coast of mainland Madagascar. The refuges were getting smaller and smaller, and the monkeys were already here on this one, sitting, making notes about it. "Well, the difference," said Mark, "is that the first monkey-free refuge was set up by chance. The second was actually set up by the monkeys." "So I suppose it's fair to say," I said, "that as our intelligence has increased, it has given us not only greater power, but also an understanding of the consequences of using that power. It's given us the ability to control our environment, but also the ability to control ourselves." "Well, up to a point," said Mark, "up to a point. There are 21 species of lemur on Madagascar now, of which the II is thought to be the rarest, which just means that it's the one that's currently closest to the edge. At one time there were over 40. Nearly half of them have been pushed over the edge already, and that's just the lemurs. Virtually everything that lives in the Madagascan rainforest doesn't live anywhere else at all, and there's only about 10% of that left. And that's just Madagascar. Have you ever been to mainland Africa?" "No." "One species after another is on the way out, and they're really major animals. There are less than 20 northern white rhino left, and there's a desperate battle going on to save them from the poachers. They're in Zaire, and the mountain gorillas, too. They're one of man's closest living relatives, but we've almost killed them off this century. But it's happening throughout the rest of the world as well. Do you know about the kakapo?" "The what?" "The kakapo. It's the world's largest, fattest, and least able to fly parrot. It lives in New Zealand. It's the strangest bird I know of, and will probably be as famous as the dodo if it goes extinct." "How many of them are there?" 40 and falling." "Do you know about the Yangtze River dolphin?"
"No."
"The Komodo dragon, the Rodrigues fruit bat?" Wait a minute, I said. I went into the hut and rummaged around in the ants for one of the monkey's most prized achievements. It consisted of a lot of twigs mashed up to a pulp and flattened out into sheets and then held together with something that had previously held a cow together. I took my Philofax outside and flipped through it while the sun streamed through the trees behind me, from which some ruffed lemurs were calling to each other. "Well," I said, sitting down on the step again, "I've just got a couple of novels to write, but, what are you doing in 1988?
"Here be chickens."
The first animal we went to look for, 3 years later, was the Komodo dragon lizard. This was an animal, like most of the animals we were going to see, about which I knew very little. What little I did know was hard to like. They are man-eaters. This is not so bad in itself. Lions and tigers are man-eaters, and though we may be intensely wary of them and treat them with respectful fear, we nevertheless have an instinctive admiration for them. We don't actually like to be eaten by them, but we don't resent the very idea. The reason, probably, is that we are mammals and so are they. There's a kind of unreconstructed species prejudice at work. A lion is one of us, but a lizard is not, and neither, for that matter, is a fish, which is why we have such an unholy terror of sharks. The Komodo lizards are also big, very big. There's one on Komodo at the moment which is over 12 feet long and stands about a yard high, which you can't help but feel is entirely the wrong size for a lizard to be, particularly if it's a man-eater and you are about to go and share an island with it. Though they are man-eaters, they don't get to eat man very often, and more generally their diet consists of goats, pigs and deer and such like, but they will only kill these animals if they can't find something that's dead already, because they are, at heart, scavengers. They like their meat bad and smelly. We don't like our meat like that and tend to be leery of things that do. I was definitely leery of these lizards. Mark had spent most of the intervening 3 years planning and researching the expeditions we were to make, writing letters, telephoning, but most often telexing, to naturalists working in the field in remote parts of the world, organising schedules, letters of introduction, and maps. He also arranged all the visas, flights and boats and accommodation, and then had to arrange them all over again when it turned out that I hadn't quite finished the novels yet. At last, they were done. I left my house in the hands of the builders, who claimed they only had 3 more weeks' work to do, and set off to fulfil my one last commitment, an author tour of Australia. I'm always very sympathetic when I hear people complaining that all they ever get on television or radio chat shows is authors honking on about their latest book. It does, on the other hand, get us out of the house and spare our families the trial of hearing us honking on about our latest book. Finally, that too is over, and we could start looking for giant lizards. We met up in a hotel room in Melbourne and examined our array of expeditionary equipment. We were Mark, myself, and Gaynor Shute, a radio producer who was going to be recording our exploits for the BBC. Our equipment was a vast array of cameras, tape recorders, tents, sleeping bags, medical supplies, mosquito coils, unidentifiable things made of canvas and nylon with metal eyelets and plastic hooks, cagoules, boots, penknives, torches, and a cricket bat. None of us would admit to having brought the cricket bat. We couldn't understand what it was doing there. We phoned room service to bring us up some beers and also to take the cricket bat away, but they didn't want it. The guy from room service said that if we were really going to look for man-eating lizards, maybe the cricket bat would be a handy thing to have. If you find you've got a dragon charging towards you at 30 miles an hour snapping its teeth, you can always drive it defensively through the covers, he said, deposited the beers and left. We hid the cricket bat under the bed, opened the beers, and let Mark explain something of what we were in for. For centuries, he said, the Chinese told stories of great scaly man-eating monsters with fiery breath, but they were thought to be nothing more than myths and fanciful imaginings. Old sailors would tell of them and would write, "Here be dragons" on their maps when they saw a land they didn't at all like the look of. And then, at the beginning of the century, a pioneering Dutch aviator was attempting to island hop his way along the Indonesian archipelago to Australia when he had engine trouble and had to crash land his plane on the tiny island of Komodo. He survived the crash, but his plane didn't. He went to search for water. As he was searching, he found a strange wide track on the sandy shore, followed the track, and suddenly found himself confronted with something that he, also, didn't at all like the look of. It appeared to be a great, scaly, man-eating monster, fully 10 feet long. What he was looking at was the thing we are going to look for, the Komodo dragon lizard. "Did he survive?" I asked, going straight for the point. "Yes, he did, though his reputation didn't. He stayed alive for 3 months and then was rescued, but when he went home everyone thought he was mad and nobody believed a word of it." "So, were the Komodo dragons," I asked, "the origin of the Chinese dragon myths?" "Well, nobody really knows, of course. At least I don't. But it certainly seems like a possibility. It's a large creature with scales, it's a man-eater, and though it doesn't actually breathe fire, it does have the worst breath of any creature known to man. But there's something else you should know about the island as well." "What?" "Have another beer first." I did. "There are," said Mark, "more poisonous snakes per square metre of ground on Komodo than on any equivalent area on Earth." There is in Melbourne a man who probably knows more about poisonous snakes than anyone else on Earth. His name is Dr. Struan Sutherland, and he has devoted his entire life to a study of venom. "And I'm bored with talking about it," he said, when we went along to see him the next morning, laden with tape recorders and notebooks. "Can't stand all these poisonous creatures, all these snakes and insects and fish and things, wretched things biting everybody, and then people expect me to tell them what to do about it. I'll tell them what to do, don't get bitten in the first place, that's the answer. I've had enough of telling people all the time. Hydroponics, now that's interesting. Talk to all you like about hydroponics. Fascinating stuff, growing plants artificially in water, very interesting technique. We'll need to know all about it if we're going to go to Mars and places. Where did you say you were going?" Komodo. "Well, don't get bitten, that's all I can say. And don't come running to me if you do, because you won't get here in time, and anyway, I've got enough on my plate. Look at this office, full of poisonous animals all over the place. See this tank? It's full of fire ants. Venomous little creatures. What are we going to do about them? Anyway, I've got some little cakes in case you're hungry. Would you like some little cakes? Can't remember where I put them. There's some tea, but it's not very good. Sit down, for heaven's sake. So, you're going to Komodo. Well, I don't know why you want to do that, but I suppose you have your reasons. There are 15 different types of snake on Komodo, and half of them are poisonous. The only potentially deadly ones are the Russell's viper, the bamboo viper, and the Indian cobra. The Indian cobra is the 15th deadliest snake in the world, and all the other 14 are here in Australia. That's why it's so hard for me to find time to get on my hydroponics with all these snakes all over the place. And spiders. The most poisonous spider is the Sydney funnel web. We get about 500 people a year bitten by spiders. A lot of them used to die, so we had to develop an antidote to stop people bothering me with it all the time. It took us years. Then we developed the snake bite detector kit. Not that you need a kit to tell you when you've been bitten by a snake, you usually know, but the kit is something that'll detect what type you've been bitten by so you can treat it properly. Would you like to see a kit? I've got a couple here in the venom fridge. Let's have a look. Oh, look, the cakes are in here too. Quick, have one while they're still fresh. Fairy cakes, I baked them myself. He handed round the snake venom detection kits and his home-baked fairy cakes and retreated back to his desk, where he beamed at us cheerfully from behind his curly beard and bow tie. We admired the kits, which were small, efficient boxes neatly packed with tiny needles, a pipette, a syringe, and a complicated set of instructions that I wouldn't want to have to read for the first time in a panic. And then we asked him how many of the snakes he'd been bitten by himself. Ah, none of them, he said. Another area of expertise I've developed is that of getting other people to handle the dangerous animals. Won't do it myself. Don't want to get bitten, do I? You know what it says on my book jackets? Hobbies? Gardening, with gloves. Fishing, with boots. Travelling, with care. That's the answer. What else? Well, in addition to the boots, wear thick, baggy trousers, and preferably have half a dozen people tramping along in front of you, making as much noise as possible. The snakes pick up the vibrations and get out of your way, unless it's a death adder, otherwise known as the deaf adder, which just lies there. People can walk straight past it and over it, and nothing happens. I've heard of 12 people in a line walking over a death adder, and the 12th person accidentally trod on it and got bitten. Normally, you're quite safe if you're 12th in line. You're not eating your cakes. Come on, get them down you. There's plenty more in the venom fridge. We asked tentatively if we could perhaps take a snake bite detector kit with us to Komodo. Ah, of course you can, of course you can. Take as many as you like. Won't do you a blind bit of good, because they're only for Australian snakes. So, what do we do if we get bitten by something deadly, then, I asked. He blinked at me as if I were stupid. Well, what do you think you do? He said, you die, of course. That's what deadly means. Well, what about cutting open the wound and sucking out the poison, I asked. Well, rather you than me, he said. I wouldn't want a mouthful of poison. I shouldn't do you any harm, though. Snake toxins have a high molecular weight, so they won't penetrate the blood vessels in the mouth the way that alcohol or some drugs do. And then the poison gets destroyed by the acids in your stomach. But it's not necessarily going to do much good, either. You're not likely to be able to get much of the poison out, but you're probably going to make the wound a lot worse trying. And in a place like Komodo, it means you'd quickly have a seriously infected wound to contend with, as well as a leg full of poison. Septicemia, gangrene, you name it, it'll kill you. Well, what about a tourniquet? Well, fine, if you don't mind having your leg off afterwards. You'd have to, because you've cut off the blood supply to it completely. It'll just die. If you can find anyone in that part of Indonesia you'd trust to take your leg off, then you're a braver man than me. Now, I'll tell you, the only thing you can do is apply a pressure bandage direct to the wound and wrap the whole leg up tightly, but not too tightly. Slow the blood flow, but don't cut it off, or you'll lose the leg. Hold your leg, or whatever bit of it is you've been bitten in, lower than your heart and your head. Keep very, very still, breathe slowly, and get to a doctor immediately. If you're on Komodo, that means a couple of days, by which time you'll be well dead. Now, the only answer, and I mean this quite seriously, is don't get bitten. There's no reason why you should. Any of the snakes there will get out of your way well before you even see them. You don't really need to worry about the snakes if you're careful. No, the things you really need to worry about are the marine creatures. What? Well, scorpionfish, stonefish, sea snakes, much more poisonous than anything on land. Get stung by a stonefish and the pain alone can kill you. People drown themselves just to stop the pain. Where are all these things? Ah, just in the sea. Tons of them. I wouldn't go near it if I were you. Full of poisonous animals. Hate them. Is there anything you do like? Yes, he said. Hydroponics. We flew to Bali. David Attenborough has said that Bali is the most beautiful place in the world, but he must have been there longer than we were and seen different bits, because most of what we saw in the couple of days we were there sorting out our travel arrangements was awful. It was just the tourist area, i.e. that part of Bali which has been made almost exactly the same as everywhere else in the world for the sake of the people who have come all this way to see Bali. The narrow, muddy streets of Kuta were lined with gift shops and hamburger bars and populated with crowds of drunken, shouting tourists, kamikaze motorcyclists, counterfeit watch sellers and small dogs. The kamikaze motorcyclists tried to pick off the tourists and the small dogs, while the tiny minibus, which we spent most of the evening in, shuttling our bags from one full hotel to another, hurtled through the motorcyclists and counterfeit watch sellers at video game speeds. Somewhere not too far from here, towards the middle of the island, there may have been heaven on earth, but hell had certainly set up business on its porch. The tourists, with their cans of lager and their fuck-off t-shirts, were particularly familiar to anyone who has seen the English at play in Spain or Greece. But I suddenly realized as I watched this that for once I didn't need to hide myself away in embarrassment. They weren't English. They were Australian. But they were otherwise so nearly identical that it started me thinking about convergent evolution, which I had better explain before I go on to say why they made me think of it. In different parts of the world, strikingly similar but completely unrelated forms of life will emerge in response to similar conditions and habitats. For instance, the aye-aye, the lemur Mark and I originally tracked down in Madagascar, has one particularly remarkable feature. Its third finger is much longer than its other fingers and is skeletally thin, almost like a twig. It uses this finger for poking around under the bark of the trees it lives in to dig out the grubs which it feeds on. There is one other creature in the world which does this, and that is the long-fingered possum, which is found in New Guinea. It has a long and skeletally thin fourth finger, which it uses for precisely the same purpose. There is no family relationship between these two animals at all, and the only common factor between them is this, an absence of woodpeckers. There are no woodpeckers in Madagascar, and no woodpeckers in Papua New Guinea. This means that there is a food source, the grubs under the bark, going free, and in these two cases, it is a mammal which has developed a mechanism for getting at it. And the mechanism they both use is the same. Different finger, same idea. But it is purely the selection process of evolution which has created the similarity, because the animals themselves are not related. Exactly the same behaviour pattern had emerged entirely independently on the other side of the world. As in the gift shop habitats of Spain or Greece or indeed Hawaii, the local people cheerfully offer themselves up for insult and abuse in return for money, which they can then spend on further despoiling their habitat to attract more money-bearing predators. "Right," said Mark, when we found some dinner that night in a tourist restaurant with plastic flowers and music and paper umbrellas in the drinks. "Here's the picture. We have to get a goat." "Here?" "No, in Labuan Bajo. Labuan Bajo is on the island of Flores and is the nearest port to Komodo. It's a crossing of about 22 miles across some of the most treacherous seas in the east. This is where the South China Sea meets the Indian Ocean, and it's riddled with cross-currents, riptides and whirlpools. It's very dangerous and could take anything up to 20 hours. "With a goat?" I said. "A dead goat." I toyed with my food. "It's best," continued Mark, "if the goat has been dead for about 3 days, so it's got a good smell going. That's more likely to attract the dragons." "You're proposing 20 hours on a boat," a small boat, added Mark, "on violently heaving seas, probably, with a 3-day-old dead goat?" "Yes." I hardly know what to say. "There's one other thing that I should probably say," said Mark, "which is that I've no idea if any of this is true. There are wildly conflicting stories, and some are probably just out of date, or even completely made up. I hope we'll have a better idea of the situation when we get to Labuan Bajo tomorrow. We're flying tomorrow via Bima, and we should be at Denpasar Airport early. It was a nightmare getting these tickets and the connecting flight, and we mustn't miss the plane." We did. Fresh eruptions of hell awaited us at Denpasar Airport, which is a turmoil of crowds and shouting with a sense of incipient violence shimmering just beneath the surface. The airline check-in man said that our flight from Bima to Labuan Bajo had not been confirmed by the travel agent, and as a result we had no seats. He shrugged and gave us back our tickets. We had been told that serenity was the best frame of mind with which to tackle Indonesia, and we decided to try it. We tried serenely to point out that it actually said confirmed on our tickets. But he explained that confirmed didn't actually mean confirmed as such. It was merely something that they wrote on tickets when people asked them to, because it saved a lot of bother and made them go away. He went away. We stood waggling our tickets serenely at thin air. Behind the check-in desk was a window, and from behind this, a thin airline official with a thin moustache, a thin tie, and a white shirt with thin epaulets sat smoking cigarettes and staring at us impassively through narrow wreaths of smoke. We waved our tickets at him, but he just shook his head very, very slightly. We marched serenely over to the ticket office, where they said it was nothing to do with them and we should talk to the travel agent. A number of decreasingly serene phone calls to the travel agent in Bali simply told us that the tickets were definitely confirmed, and that's all there was to it. The ticket office told us that they definitely weren't, and that's all there was to it. "What about another flight?" we asked. "Maybe," they said, "maybe in a week or two." "A week or two?" we exclaimed. "Moment," said one of the men, took our tickets and went away with them. About 10 minutes later he returned and gave them to a second man, who said, "Moment," and went away with them in turn. He returned 15 minutes later, looked at us and said, "Yes, what do you want to know?" We explained the situation all over again, whereupon he nodded, said, "Moment," and disappeared again. When, after a longish while had passed, we asked where he was, we were told he had gone to visit his mother in Jakarta because he hadn't seen her in 3 years. Had he taken our tickets with him, we inquired. No, they were here somewhere, we were told. Did we want them? Yes, we did, we explained. We were trying to get to Labuan Bajo. This news seemed to cause considerable consternation, and within minutes, everyone in the office had gone to lunch. It became clear that the plane was going to leave without us. We had the option of doing the first part of the flight as far as Bima, and then being stranded there, but decided instead to stay in Bali and go and deal with the travel agent. No more Mr. Serene guys. A minibus took us back to the travel agency, where we stormed slowly up the stairs with all our baggage and angrily refused to sit and have coffee and listen to a machine which played Greensleeves whenever the phone rang. There was a sense of muted horror in the air, as if one of us had died, but no one actually paid any attention to us for nearly an hour. So in the end we started to get angry again and were immediately shown into the office of the director of the agency, who sat us down and told us that the Indonesians were a proud race and that furthermore it was the fault of the airline. He then soothed us a great deal, told us that he was a very powerful man in Bali, and explained that it did not help the situation that we got angry about it. This was a point of view with which I had some natural sympathy, being something of a smiler and nodder myself, who generally registers anger and frustration by frowning a lot and going to sleep. On the other hand, I couldn't help noticing that all the time we had merely smiled and nodded and laughed pleasantly when we had been laughed pleasantly at, nothing had happened, and people had merely said, "moment, moment," a lot, and gone to Jakarta, or peered at us impassively through narrow wreaths of smoke. As soon as we had geared ourselves up to get angry and stamp our feet a bit, we had been instantly whisked to the office of the director of the travel agency, who was busy telling us that there was no point in us getting angry, and that he would arrange an extra flight, especially for us, to Labuan Bajo. He tried to demonstrate the uselessness of stamping our feet to us with maps. "In these areas," he said, pointing to a large wall map of half of Asia, "it works. East of this line here, it doesn't work." He explained that if you're travelling in Indonesia, you should allow 4 or 5 days for anything urgent to happen. As far as our missing plane seats were concerned, he said that this sort of thing happened all the time. Often some government official or other important person would decide that he needed a seat, and of course someone else would then lose theirs. We asked if this was what had happened to us. He said no, it wasn't the reason, but it was the sort of reason we should bear in mind when thinking about these problems. At this point, we agreed to have the coffee. He organised hotel rooms for us for the night, and a minibus tour of the island for the afternoon. There is a good living to be made in Bali, we discovered, from pointing at animals. First, find your animal, and then point at it. If you set yourself up properly, you can even make a living from pointing at the person who is pointing at the animal. We found a very good example of this enterprise on the beach near the famous temple of Tan Alot, and apparently it was a long-established and thriving business. Up on the beach there was a very low, wide cave, inside which, in a small cranny in the wall, a couple of yellow snakes had made their home. Outside on the beach was a man who sat on a box and collected the money, and pointed at the man in the cave. Once you had paid your money, you crept into the cave, and the man in the cave pointed at the snakes. Apart from this highlight, the guided tour was profoundly depressing. When we told our guide that we didn't want to go to all the tourist places, he took us instead to the places where they take tourists who say that they don't want to go to tourist places. These places are, of course, full of tourists. Which is not to say that we weren't tourists every bit as much as the others, but it does highlight the irony that everything you go to see is changed by the very action of going to see it, which is the sort of problem which physicists have been wrestling with for most of the century. I'm not going to bang on about Bali being turned into a Bali theme park, in which Bali itself is gradually destroyed to make way for a tatty, artificial version of what used to be there, because it is too familiar a process to come as news to anybody. I just want to let out a squeak of frustrated rage. I'm afraid I couldn't wait to leave the most beautiful place on earth. The following day, we finally succeeded in leaving Denpasar Airport for Bima. Everyone knew us from the ructions of the day before, and this time the narrow man who had peered at us through wreaths of smoke was wreathed in smiles and terribly helpful. This, though, was only softening us up. At Bima, we were told, there was no flight at all to Labuan Bajo till the following morning. Perhaps we would like to come back then. At that point, we started to get into a bit of a frenzy, And then suddenly, we were unexpectedly seized and pushed through the crowds and shoved onto a dilapidated little plane that was sitting fully loaded on the tarmac, waiting to take off for Labuan Bajo. On the way to the plane, we couldn't help noticing that we passed our pile of intrepid baggage sitting on a small, unregarded baggage cart out in the middle of the tarmac. Once we were on the plane, we sat and debated nervously with each other about whether we thought they might be thinking of loading it. Eventually, my nerve broke, and I got off the plane and started running back across the tarmac. I was quickly intercepted by airline staff, who demanded to know what I thought I was doing. I said baggage a lot and pointed. They insisted that everything was okay, there was no problem, and that everything was under control. I persuaded them at last to come with me to the baggage cart standing in the middle of the tarmac. With hardly a change of beat, they moved smoothly from assuring me that all our baggage was on board the plane to helping me actually get it on board. That done, we could finally relax about the baggage and start seriously to worry about the state of the plane, which was terrifying. The door to the pilot's cockpit remained open for the duration of the flight and might actually have been missing entirely. Mark told me that Air Merpati bought their plane second-hand from Air Uganda, but I think he was joking. I have a cheerfully reckless view of this kind of air travel. It rarely bothers me at all. I don't think this is bravery, because I'm frequently scared stiff in cars, particularly if I'm driving. But once you're in an aeroplane, everything is completely out of your hands, so you may just as well sit back and grin manically about the grinding and rattling noises the old wreck of a plane makes as the turbulence throws it round the sky. There's nothing you can do. Mark was watching the instruments in the cockpit with curious intensity, and after a while said that half of them simply weren't working. I laughed, a little hectically, I admit, and said that it was probably just as well. If the instruments were working, they would probably distract and worry the pilots, and I'd rather they just got on with what they were doing. Mark thought that this was not at all an amusing observation, and he was clearly right, but nevertheless I laughed again, really rather a lot, and carried on laughing wildly for most of the rest of the flight. Mark turned and asked a passenger behind us if these planes ever crashed. Oh yes, he was told, but not to worry, there hadn't been a serious crash now in months. Landing at Labuan Bajo was interesting because the pilots couldn't get the flaps down. We were quite interested to know, for instance, as the trees at the end of the runway loomed closer and closer and the two pilots were tugging with all their combined weight on the ceiling-mounted lever, whether we were all going to live or not. At the last moment, the lever suddenly gave way and we banged down onto the runway in a subdued and reflective frame of mind. We climbed off the plane and, after lengthy negotiations, persuaded the airline staff to take our baggage off as well, since we thought we'd probably like to have it with us.